because the Chinese also said national security is everything. It's economic security, it's financial security, it's broad, it's all these various other areas itself. So the US and China have become to see this expansive definition.
China 21 is produced by the 21st Century China Center at UC San Diego School of Global Policy and Strategy. We are a university-based think tank that produces original research to anchor major policy discussions on China and its relationship to the United States. This podcast features expert voices, insights, and stories about Chinese economy, politics, society, and the implications for international affairs. Learn more at china.ucsd.edu. The rivalry between the U.S. and China in the pursuit of advanced technologies is intensifying. Specifically, Chinese technology investment in the U.S. and other countries are posing a new set of challenges that is blurring the principles of free market competition, national security, and technological innovation. In today's episode, three experts on Chinese innovation policy will discuss the China factor in the peculiar case of the U.S. government's protection of Qualcomm, and what kind of tools and policies will emerge as the rules of engagement in international investment and technological competition become murkier and fraught with geopolitical tensions. Dr. Barry Naughton is one of America's most highly respected economists working on China. He holds the So Kwan Luk Chair on Chinese International Affairs at UC San Diego School of Global Policy and Strategy, or GPS. Dr. Taiming Cheng is an associate professor at GPS and the director of the Institute on Global Conflict and Cooperation, based here at UC San Diego. He leads IGCC's Minerva Project on the evolving relationship between technology and national security in China. Miko Huatari is the head of the Geoeconomics and International Security Program at the Mercator Institute of China Studies, or MERICS, based in Berlin, Europe's largest independent think tank dedicated to research on contemporary China. He is currently a visiting scholar here at the 21st Century China Center.
Yesterday, President Trump made a surprise announcement that that CFIUS, the Commission on Foreign Investment in the United States, would not approve and in fact ended a deal by Broadcom to take over local San Diego company Qualcomm. This action was a big surprise for a lot of people. Although CFIUS had already weighed in on the deal, they had asked shareholders of Qualcomm and Broadcom to delay the deal, but it was a big shock to everybody that they decided to move forward so decisively and at such a surprising time. In fact, this issue raises an enormous number of related security and economic issues. I'm going to start out by asking Taiming Cheng to tell us what the important security issues are that the Qualcomm-Broadcom merger raised in this case.
So there's a couple of very important issues here, Barry. First is that what exactly is national security itself? And what we see from this decision is that it's becoming increasingly broadened itself. I mean, even before this, last week there was the tariffs that national security was on steel and aluminium. And now it's very clear, it's expanded to high tech, etc. And more broadly, according to the CFIUS letter, it's about innovation, right? That Qualcomm is such a critical element of the US national innovation system that any threat to that from foreign acquisition can be stopped on national security terms. So what we see here with the Qualcomm issue is that the U.S. has put national security front and center in how it sees the world and how it sees the geo-economic relationship, in particular dealing with China.
And of course, what's peculiar about this case is that the security considerations that were front and center in the CFIUS letter were about Qualcomm's deep research effort and the fact that it has such a prominent position in the development of 5G telecom. Why is that so important?
Because 5G is one of the critical components for the economy going forwards, right? For it's like artificial intelligence, for it's like the next generation of autonomous vehicles, etc. I mean, it's all about information. Right? And when the US looks at who are going to be the big players in this, both in terms of countries, in terms of companies, their main competitor is highlighted to be China itself. So so in particular, Huawei has been mentioned very, very explicitly. So what we see here is this competition on the economic and the security and the technology front. That's all merging itself. And whether that's the case or not, I mean, the US has made it clear now that it's like that we're in a technological an innovation race with China, and we can't do anything to undermine the U.S. competitiveness. But the big one of the bigger issues is, so with the CFIUS, what we're doing is we're putting the barriers in place, but there's nothing in there in the decision or broadly about how the U.S. is going to support the U.S. innovation system itself. It's like, I mean, yes, we can prevent companies, foreign companies, from taking these crown jewels, etc. But what are we? What is the U.S. actually going to do to encourage more research and development and innovation itself? And that's one of the pieces that should be really addressed, but we haven't seen that yet.
Yeah. Now, there are a lot of curious things about this decision, but before we dig into it, let's talk a little bit about this competition, and in particular this sort of emerging duopoly in 5G telecom between the U.S. and Qualcomm on the one hand, and China and Huawei on the other hand. These two companies are really, they're really the only main players globally right now, right? And so the issue of sort of who owns the technology, who has the capabilities, is especially critical in this respect, because there are only two companies that are real players. Miko, how does this duopoly look from Europe's standpoint?
Well, it's pretty clear that European governments have taken a fundamentally different path with regard to our perception and also the way how European companies, leading telecommunications operators, actually deal with Huawei in particular. So Huawei is deeply engaged and present in the European markets, part of the critical infrastructures in certain countries, and is about to emerge as the key partner for 5G development in a lot of European countries. So on that particular aspect, it's pretty clear that until recently, at least, our concerns on the European level haven't been as expressed as in the US currently, which means it's highly likely that we see a divergence on that particular aspect of innovation and technological development.
Yeah. In fact, most of the world, I was just in Mexico, which is in a very similar situation. Their telecom infrastructure is mostly now being built out by Huawei. So most of the world is looking at Huawei as a primarily commercial, highly cost competitive supplier, while the United States was already saying, well, Huawei could not participate in U.S. infrastructure, and now is kind of ramping that up a step with this move to protect Qualcomm. Ty, do you think that makes sense, that American policy is reasonable, or are you more of a critic?
I mean, I'm more of a critic because, I mean, these are very globalized companies. I mean, yes, I mean, there's the U.S. and there's the Chinese dimensions, and the national security is an important part. But it's like, but when you look at, the global footprints, this engagement with so many countries itself, it's very, very difficult to be able to draw very clear cut boundaries. And so the problem with national security is black and white. And today we're increasingly in this very blurred world. And if you do what the US is doing itself, I mean, you're forcing the Europeans or many other countries in the world to take sides when it's like, when, and the problem is like, we don't know where the lines are. itself. So I think it's and the problem also with the U.S. is like so a lot of this decision, like with the Qualcomm decision, it was very quick. It happened almost overnight, and so it seems more of an ad hoc response, and there's no clear-cut strategic thinking about what is going on.
Well, and when we talk about the fuzziness of this, of course, at the core of it is also the fact that Broadcom is only nominally a foreign company. It's registered in Singapore, but it's only been there for a couple years, and it has its roots in two United States companies. And, of course, it had promised to move its registration back to the United States. So CFIUS's unambiguous jurisdiction only comes from the fact that Broadcom is a foreign company, which it's not 100% clear that it is a foreign company.
Right.
Yeah. And it's funny, too, that the CFIUS statement seemed to display a certain amount of exasperation with Broadcom. In other words, they almost seem to have said, well, we're taking this action quickly because Broadcom sort of refused to slow down the process and listen to our concerns. Does this reflect the fact that the mandate of CFIUS and policy toward foreign investment in the United States, especially investment from China, is changing on a broader scale? Miko, maybe I'll turn that to you.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's pretty obvious that not only in the United States, but also elsewhere, we are in a context where governments are changing their approach to foreign investment.
Globally.
Mm-hmm. But particularly in advanced economies with a view on both critical infrastructures and high tech. And the timing of this decision is so important here because, of course, we are in the process of CFIUS reform, where another bill, FIRMA, will kick in most likely this year. And so this decision basically has anticipated an approach that's legally not yet in place, in a sense. And in Europe, we are struggling with similar problems. So we have a situation where in Germany, for instance, we've already revised certain aspects of our approach, how we deal with foreign investment in high tech and in other aspects. But at the European level, we're not there yet. So there's also this uncertainty about how, in future cases, in the near future, where a Chinese company would buy one of the crown jewels of European industry, how this would be actually handled. So I think it's a very critical time currently, and this decision brings everything together, highlighting all the challenges that we have.
It seems like in Europe, Angela Merkel is already very much aware and focused on this issue, but maybe, say, the Italian government, Italy doesn't even yet have a new government. They're clearly not prepared to deal with this issue yet.
Well, if you look back the last 24 months, it's been a surprising development on the European level, where Germany, France, and Italy actually have collaborated to push the European Commission towards a more coordinated approach vis-a-vis high-tech investments, and this approach is going to focus much more focusedly on national security. So it's not likely that it's going to be as expansive as what we are now anticipating in the United States. But it was across different governments. Germany has certainly been in the lead of this process, but also taking up a lot of willingness from the French side, who have traditionally had a much more careful and, I'd say, protectionist perspective on investment per se.
And you raise a very important point about the U.S. by contrast with Europe. Clearly, the Trump administration has mixed security and what we might call protectionist motives actually in every one of these decisions. I mean, of course, the authority for the steel and aluminum tariffs is drawn from security, from the president's ability to act for security. There's a very important Section 301 case going forward on intellectual property rights. Perhaps that's a little bit better targeted in terms of dealing with China. But once again, the power to do it is taken on the security front. And of course, in this Qualcomm case as well, it's a security justification. Even though in all these cases, at least a very important part of the motivation, and maybe the majority of it, is really economic.
Well, so that's a very interesting point, Barry, because if you look at since December, there's been a number of policy documents that's come out from the Trump administration. The National Security Strategy, the National Defense Strategy are the two most prominent ones. And in the National Security Strategy that provides sort of the vision for the Trump administration, it says very clearly that national security is economic security itself. And that's sort of where it's sort of like the two are almost indistinguishable, which is also very curious because that sort of harks out to what the Chinese have defined. Because the Chinese also said national security is everything. It's economic security, it's financial security, it's broad, it's all these various other areas itself. So the US and China have become to see this expansive definition. And when Miko mentioned, it's like in Europe, how do they define national security then in that sense?
Well, as I said, I think it's much more focused still. But if you listen to the concerns that people are raising, it's also much more about economic competitiveness. So it's about China's economic rise as a state-led economy, most broadly, and all the consequences that has for technological leadership, for instance. And that's certainly the set of concerns that we have in Germany. But we're trying to use national security tools to deal with these problems, which for sure is going to lead to problems legally, but also in the long run, I'm not convinced that we have the right tools actually in place if we only focus on these core national security concerns.
And of course, I think in the States, there's a consensus that we don't have the right tools in place, but there's no consensus on exactly what the right tools would be and what we should do. Is there a danger that we're going to go too far?
I mean, I think that there is because, I mean, first of all, I mean, the tools that we have in place on dealing with national security, like export controls and these CIFs, they all came out from the 1970s, right, during the previous Cold War between the US and the Soviet Union itself. And that was when technology and innovation and globalization itself were very, very different itself. So what we're trying to do is trying to address current issues and the long-term future with these very obsolete tools. And even if we are refining these with these new regulations and laws coming up, it's not clear that it's like they really take into account what the innovation landscape is. So, yeah. So that's one of the big problems.
And it's funny because this contradiction is sort of at the core both of Chinese policy and of American policy. Chinese policy is in some ways so peculiar because China is so deeply integrated into global production networks, so deeply integrated into global innovation efforts. And yet at the same time, it's also launching this massive state-directed program of innovation designed to give it mastery in certain selected industries. It's deeply contradictory in some ways.
Well, it is, but I also see it as very complementary. So I see that there's these two models on parallel tracks, that there's a lot of interconnectedness. There's one is this, as you mentioned, this state-led, top-down model that's very much focused on what the Chinese call original innovation, about how they try to do a lot of their research and development in-house and focus on this techno-nationalist model. At the same time, the Chinese, I mean, they've prospered being globally integrated, so especially on these production and on some of the research and innovation chains. And what they want to do is we want to also invest in that itself and use that to be remaining globally invested. But we want to choose between those two, and we want to use the outward-looking model and feed that into the inward model.
We want the best of both worlds. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Do you think it's feasible?
The Chinese have been pretty successful at that. I mean, previously they've been very much focused on the externally connected model, and now they see that there's these concerns, and now it's a race against time. And especially as these national security barriers come up, they really have to beef up their internally orientated model. I think it's, I mean, they're so big. I mean, China's so big and these barriers are so blurred. It's like they can sort of like take advantage of sort of like of the messiness that's out there. So I think that they can benefit until we get a time when the U.S. and the rest of the world can get their act together, if that even happens.
So it could be that the Qualcomm case. I mean, what's peculiar about the Qualcomm case, as you indicated before, is that it shows the U.S. government thinking about technological capabilities in a way that's rather similar to the way the Chinese think about technological capabilities. So in a way, CFIUS said, look, Qualcomm is such a great resource in terms of its research and development capabilities, including the fact that it's a trusted supplier to the U.S. government, that we need to protect this against, let's call them, predatory business practices or predatory business strategies. In a way, they were more opposed to the business strategy of Broadcom than they were to the fact that Broadcom happens to be domiciled in Singapore, which may or may not be relevant in this case, according to some additional facts. So maybe we'll see this as a turning point where this is the first time that the U.S. government starts to say, well, we have certain core technological capabilities that we need to protect.
I mean, it would be good if that's the case, but it's going to be one other fact that I've always like been puzzled by today is so when we look at so like the Qualcomm and the importance of innovation, the U.S. model, which is fundamentally different from the Chinese model, is this bottom-up process of innovation. But there's this talk about, do we need industrial policies? Do we need competition policy or innovation policies? But it's one of the reminders of where the Trump administration thinks about this is they have not appointed an innovation czar. They don't have a science and technology czar. The office of the science and technology advisor to the White House has not been filled, and there's no indication that's going to. So on one side, we see these rules and regulations and these barriers being put up. On this other hand, I don't see much of like an effort to to build up this capacity for promoting innovation.
So we're backing into an industrial policy without a clear rationale. Is that a danger in Europe as well?
We certainly have similar debates, I would say that is a much more, there's a stronger tradition to think in terms of industrial policy, certainly in the French case. Increasingly also a greater willingness in Germany to think about, for instance, German or European capabilities. That's the approach, actually, European capabilities in the chip industry or battery technology, or you've recently seen mergers in train manufacturing, etc. Because we feel the competition, of course, internationally by the Chinese in particular. So I think, yes, this is a trajectory where we for sure will have a much more coordinated approach towards protecting and developing core industries. And we have language in European documents on enabling technologies that we need to support with European money. We have a European defense fund that's going to finance certain critical technologies, etc. So I think it's happening already. We're in an era where industrial policy is back with a view on these technologies.
So it's funny, this is the last couple of weeks there have been so much news about the economy and security, and although the new configuration of policies maybe isn't really clear yet, it is clear enough that this has been a kind of a turning point. These last couple of weeks have marked a permanent change in the trajectory of at least American policy, and the details of it will only emerge gradually. Tai, are you optimistic or pessimistic about China U.S. relations and what the Chinese response to this new reality is going to be?
I wish I was more optimistic, but it's if you look at the various drivers itself, on the U.S. side itself, I mean, it's like whether it's not just the Qualcomm policy, but it's this notion about like great power competition that is now sort of dominating. It's been dominant in the national security sphere for the last few years, and now we see that sort of crossing over towards all parts of the government itself. So the U.S. emphasizes now they're now in this great power competition, and China has been trying to play that down, but it's like, but I see they are also engaged in this game, and almost week by week, month by month, this competition, it's like increasingly is coupled, and increasingly there's an action reaction, and where it's primarily once been in the defense and military spheres, now with what we see on the technology side, that's sort of being dragged in itself, and now we're going to see more on the trade side on and in the investment side itself, and we don't see the two leaderships trying to head this off. In fact, if you look at the rhetoric from the Chinese leadership or from the Trump administration, it's that we need to do more of this and push this down. So it's a fairly bleak near to medium to long term.
Yeah, because in the immediately speaking, nobody wants to look weak. Everybody wants to show that they're as tough or tougher than the other guy. And I guess if we want to put a silver lining on this dark cloud, it is that perhaps if these two great countries do see each other as long-term rivals, but with a degree of predictability and a certain understanding of what the rules of the game for competition and rivalry might be, then perhaps we can have a stable and a peaceful relationship.
Yes, if we know what the rules of the game are, but I think we're in a very different order down from the past.
And nobody knows what the rules are yet.
Right.
Thank you very much, Miko and Ty.
Thank you, Barry.
Thank you for listening to China 21, the podcast of the 21st Century China Center at UC San Diego School of Global Policy and Strategy. Visit china.ucsd.edu and connect with us on social media. 谢谢大家.